Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The act of a writer writing about another author's work and influence is a common experience, but usually that writer has been well-read in their subject's works and experience. J.C. Holman, on the other hand, took a completely different approach. He's written about writer Nicholson Baker as he experienced his novels and stories for the first time, beginning with Baker's own book about his regard of the writings of John Updike, titled You and I. In B and Me, Holman writes of his emerging literary relationship with Baker, but also of his own life and his writings. The book demonstrates how a deep reading of an author can obsess us and at the same time give us new insights into our own lives. It's funny and irreverent, yet argues that considered reading can have a profound effect on us, even in a day of countless digital distractions. B and Me, A True Story of Literary Arousal, is published by Simon & Schuster. J.C. Holman's nonfiction combines memoir, history, journalism, and travelogue. His previous books have included The Chess Artist, about his friendship with a chess player, and Utopia, an exploration of utopian thought with visits to utopian communities, and William & Henry, which examines the correspondence of William & Henry James. He's also edited two anthologies, The Story About the Story, 1 and 2, which advocates an idea which he returns to in his latest book, known as Creative Criticism. He'll be appearing at a BookSmart Tulsa event this evening at 7 o'clock at Lucky's on the Guthrie Green. J.C. Holman is my guest today. J.C. Holman, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and welcome to Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich. It's great to be here.
This book, B and Me, it's an homage to you and I, Nicholson Baker's book about his own sort of semi-obsession with John Updike. This book is somewhat the same. How did you get into reading about Nicholson Baker? You write in early in the book that said, you know, this is one of these authors you should read, but he's not quite in the canon yet. And for whatever reason, you never read him. And all of a sudden, you become obsessed with reading Nicholson Baker.
Yeah, I'd gotten interested in how we write about literature many years ago, and had thought for a long time about a kind of covert tradition of writing about books, the way that writers write about books as opposed to literary critics. And so I'd read a whole bunch of literary relationship stories, essays or books by, you know, someone writing about their relationship with an author. And I noticed that even though there were many, many examples of these, and what no one had ever done, no one had ever really told a literary relationship story from its moment of conception, that moment when you first hear of a writer and say to yourself, I want to read that person. And that was strange because we experienced this over the course of our lifetimes dozens, if not hundreds of times. And so eventually I thought about this author, Nicholson Baker, who I knew had written this important literary relationship book about John Updike, but I'd never read him. And so I realized I should. And so I wanted to tell a story like that. And so at that moment, before I'd ever read a word of Nicholson Baker, I sat down and started writing B and Me. So if someone's out there saying to themselves, well, I've never read Nicholson Baker, how could I read a book about him? Well, the irony is that if that's what you're thinking to yourself, well, that's exactly the position I was in when I started writing this book.
But this book is about far more than just an homage to a writer and about reading a writer's work. It's really about everything from the state of literature to the state of literary criticism. And you really call this, I think you call this work, a work of creative criticism. What do you mean by that?
Well, that was an idea that I kind of threw out at a sort of early moment in my time thinking about how we write about literature. I was in an interview to teach a class at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was asked, well, what kind of class would you like to offer? And I hadn't really thought about that before I went into this interview, oddly enough. And what just came to me was an essay that I had written about Henry James, and I'd approached it in a very personal way as opposed to a dispassionate, critical way. And I said, well, I don't know, maybe I could do something for the students like that, offer them an opportunity to have that same kind of experience. Maybe it could be like a kind of creative criticism. And the interviewer said, sounds like a class. And I was immediately hired. And it turned out that that phrase was not mine. There was a critic named J.E. Spingarn early in the 20th century who had first coined that phrase, building off a remark from Goethe. So this idea that there would be a different kind of writing about reading than the kind that we all get indoctrinated with in high school and early in our college careers, that dispassionate argument-based writing. There's an alternative to that, and it's been the way that writers have written about literature for a long, long time. And all it really means is that a piece of writing about literature can have all of the same kinds of emotions that literature itself has. It can be angry, it can be passionate, it can be sad, it can be poignant, it can be arousing, it can be about love, it can have all of those emotions. And it seems really strange when you think about it that even though literature has all those emotions, that we would have ever decided that our writing about literature would not have that.
And in the case of Bee and Me, this is a book that is about that exploration of a writer, and you're in many cases sort of echoing the sort of same themes that you see in You and I. But at the same time, this is about you as much as about Baker, and it's about your own process of discovery of his writing and your own growth, emotional growth, the writing growth, and everything else that happens during this period of time.
Right, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways in which Bee and Me is building off of what You and I did. And mm-hmm. You and I, Baker's book about John Updike, was itself building off of what Updike saw Frederick Exley doing in Pages from a Cold Eyewind, in which Exley was thinking about the critic and writer Edmund Wilson. And yet, Bee and Me is also very different from You and I in a few ways. I mean, in You and I, what Baker does, his gimmick in You and I is that he is going to write a book about Updike, but he's going to remember having read Updike. He's never going to go back and reconsult him.
Right.
And that's the premise of that book.
And of course, that has all sorts of faulty memories, too.
Right, yeah. I mean, and of course, that rang true for a lot of readers because that's our experience of writers. We read them and we go through multiple books, and then maybe those memories slip out of our mind. And that's, so even that book was kind of true to our reading experience in a novel way. But what I did, because I hadn't read Nicholson Baker at all, I couldn't do that. So I did more or less the opposite in my book. I actually told the story of reading him from that moment of conception all the way through to reading all of his work. And so it's almost the exact opposite in terms of what I did, but it is similar in tone.
The first 50 pages, it's about you not reading Nicholson Baker.
yeah. I mean, and I thought that was that's true, too. I mean, we are, you know, that's true to our reading lives as well, because we're always sort of hearing of writers and we're constantly.
You buy the book, it sits on a stack and it sits there. And
yeah. And there's even a long period probably before we even buy the book. You know, you hear of writers all the time, and, you know, you go to cocktail parties and people mention some obscure writer, and then you read a review, or and then you hear an interview on the radio or whatever. And eventually you say to yourself, I need to buy that book. But even when you then buy the book, when does hectic modern life actually afford you the opportunity to sit down and begin reading them? And I think what I was trying to get at with that is the suggestion that, that is something we've forgotten, which is that a reading life is a demanding experience in the same way that climbing a mountain is a demanding experience. You know, you really have to plan it, yet climbing mountains is something people choose to do with their leisure time. Mm-hmm. And so that was what I was trying to get at with that, that it's difficult. It's something that doesn't just happen all at once.
So you had this germ of an idea, and so you had the copy of the book. It's sitting around. It's moving around the house, various places.
It's seeming to move.
Yeah. And it's a soft cover, so, you know, the getting a little humid, and all of a sudden the title's folding. And as you're writing the book, he says, you know, I need to start this book, but I just start reading and then I just put it aside. I can't get going on this. And eventually you start reading it. And then that's when the book really takes off.
Yeah, that was the kind of the great irony. You know, as I'd been doing all of this reading of these literary relationship stories, I actually wound up compiling them. And I did an anthology of that work. It's called The Story About the Story. It appeared from Tin House Books in mm-hmm. 2009. And that I did not anthologize Nicholson Baker in that book, and I later realized that I probably should have. But just a couple of months, you know, so I already had, you know, Nicholson Baker's, you know, You and I lying around the house. And but just a couple of months after my anthology was published, Nicholson Baker published another book. He published a book called The Anthologists. And suddenly, you know, hearing of Nicholson Baker on the radio or in advertisements, suddenly that was the breaking point. That was the moment when I realized this author has something to do with me. He bears on me in some way. And I think that's really what draws us to writers. You know, when we really realize that somehow what they're writing about is us. And when we feel indicted or included, that's when we finally make the leap and say, now I need to read that person.
Before we get away from criticism, you had some really interesting insights. This is, you know, that you were talking about Henry James earlier, and you've written about Henry James. And so the first time you read Turn of the Screw, you had a completely different experience than you expected, because critics had told you to expect one thing, and what you found was this huge discrepancy in the actual book than what critics had told you about.
Yeah.
I find this to be a real issue in literature. It can be off-putting to people exploring new writers. I wonder if you'd expound on that a little bit.
Sure. Well, when I talk about this sort of tradition of literary relationship stories, where writers are writing essays about their experience, a lifelong experience sometimes, with a particular author, their relationship with an author, that is something in traditional literary critical circles, not all of them, and not forever, but that is almost verboten, you know, to think too much about the author, or even to grant the author jurisdiction over their own work, is something that many critics would resist. And this often gets called the death of the author, where the author loses their own control over the text. And what was really interesting to me in reading The Turn of the Screw for the very first time was that I realized I had expectations about the book, even though I hadn't read it, that somehow the critical tradition of that book had gotten through to me, and I expected it to be about a repressed spinster, because that was sort of the take on that's the critical take on that mm-hmm. book. But then I read it, and I sensed something completely different in it, and I didn't feel the need to not listen to what the author had to say, so I sought out what Henry James had to say about his own book, and he had commented on his own book in an introduction that was published about 10 years later, in which he suggested some very, very different things. And that was kind of the beginning of my whole thinking about criticism and how we write about reading, because I realized that if you really return to the idea that reading is about having a relationship with an author, then reading becomes a very, very different kind of thing for you.
Hmm. Now, as you began reading Nicholson Baker, there's always a chance that that relationship isn't going to take. You know, you're going to find that person brittle or hard to take or whatever. What was your experience as you began reading Nicholson Baker?
Well, you know,
And you have this idea that I'm going to write about this, and I'm going to write about this contemporaneously.
Well, that was kind of the funny part of it. I mean, I said to myself, okay, I'm going to write this book about Nicholson Baker, and I wrote what is really the first 20, 25 pages of the book. And then I had to go through a period where I was actually selling the book, because, you know, nonfiction books these days tend to sell through book proposals. So I tell that story. And of course, the book proposal that I wrote simply said, I'm going to write a book about an author that many people haven't heard of, and I haven't read him yet, and it's going to be great. Please pay me.
And your agent was incredibly enthusiastic about that idea.
Well, my original agent wasn't all that enthusiastic about it, and so I had to move on to a different agent, and I found the right person, and then I found the wonderful people at Simon & Schuster, who were willing to go along on this very speculative ride with me. And when I actually dived into the work of Nicholson Baker, it was an almost endless stream of finding my own thinking echoed back at me. I realized that he had been informing and influencing me remotely through other writers, because many of the people that I'd read, that I'd even anthologized, had read and been informed by Nicholson Baker. So his work was getting through to me through indirect routes, which really illustrates how literature works in the world. And is something we don't think about.
What about his like magazine writing and things like that, or, you know, his articles and things like that? Is that something you never read as well?
I just never read it. You know, I don't know why. You know, I mean, it was I speculate in the book that maybe it was because, you know, we're not that far apart in age. You know, mm-hmm. and you know, I'm trying to be very honest about the literary world in this book.
I think at some point you're saying, you know, I thought of Nicholson Baker as being sort of this uppity Brit or something like that, and you know, you just kind of go through a whole range of reasons why you hadn't read it.
Right. Well, the name Nicholson Baker at first struck me as probably being an English name, and I didn't even realize he was American, and that was how little I knew. And it turns out that that's not an entirely inappropriate thought, because particularly his early books did really well, maybe even better in England than they did here.
And they have that sort of European sensibility in a lot of ways.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, as you began reading them, you began seeing all these connections in your own life. You're reading You and I, and then all of a sudden it's going on beyond You and I to sort of look at his whole life. And you said, I remember there was one thing you said. It said, it's a daunting task to go back to a writer's first book that you've already decided you like, and going back to that first book because that's the beginning, and it may not be quite as good as what you know now. And there was a whole range of discussion about that first book. What's important about that first book?
It's the thing that really establishes the trajectory of their career. And for me, it was also the question of age. You know, I was 42 years old when I started working on this book, and Baker published his first book, The Mezzanine, which is another book that is a kind of writer's writer book, and it's a kind of classic. And Baker published it when he was 31, and he'd been working on it for a few years. And so it was daunting to me because I was going back to this classic book that was written by someone who was, at the time, 10 years younger than me. And I think that's at one point I speculate that my whole entire relationship with Nicholson Baker would be a whole lot easier if he was already dead. You know, this idea that he was writing these things that were so important to me that it shaped my life and my thought through other writers and had done it when he was much younger than I was, what was itself daunting.
My guest today is J.C. Holman. His new book is titled Bee and Me, A True Story of Literary Arousal. It's about his reading about Nicholson Baker, which begins with You and I, Baker's homage sort of to John Updike. And then, of course, he reads the whole catalog of Baker during the course of this and finds all these relationships. And then he has all these wonderful tangents into his own life and his own writing. It gets into everything from the state of criticism to the state of literature to what's going on in libraries and what's happening to the written page and the future of books and everything in between. And it's a really fun read. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be appearing this evening at 7 o'clock at a BookSmart Tulsa event at Lucky's on the Green. And it should be great weather to be outdoors and have a great book event tonight. Yeah. As you began reading more about Baker, you found all these parallels to your own life. One is Baker was a musician for a time. He played a bassoon, I believe.
And, he was a bassoonist. Yes.
Yep, and you played trombone. And there's a very funny story about your own trombone career. But you had a which you may want to tell, but there was a really strong thought about the act of reading, talking about how reading a book or reading is like sight reading music.
Right, yeah.
I thought that was a really interesting insight.
Thank you. And well, let me go back and tell that story because I think it is really funny and interesting. So one of Baker's earliest short stories, even though he was a bassoonist, is a story called Playing Trombone. And that's the great connection between you and I. We were both trombonists.
Yeah.
And so I found Playing Trombone, which is hard to find because it's not collected in any of his books. And it's a wonderful, wonderful story. I really wish it had been republished somewhere. And in that story, there's this moment when the kind of prodigy trombone player, you know, has to, in a concert, hit a really, really high note. And he just barely manages it. It's like a really critical moment in the story. And the amazing thing was that I'd had that exact experience as a trombonist in a youth symphony that went to Europe. And I had a really diabolical Italian conductor who was very upset because I didn't have a particularly good ear as a trombonist, and you actually really need to have a very good ear as a trombonist because basically the only moving part on a trombone is a big tuning slide, and so if you don't have a good ear, you're going to be out of tune a lot. And there was this moment at the end of Shostakovich No. 5 where the trumpet and the trombone and a French horn all have to hit the same note, and on trombone it was a high A, and it's a really, really impossible note to hit. And so I had this exact experience. So that was, you know, going all the way back to the earliest moments of Nicholson Baker's career, my life and my experience just seemed to completely overlap with the things that he'd written about. The relationship between music and reading is It's right on the surface. I mean, you compose music, you compose prose. You read music, you read prose. And so those relationships are all there. But the thing that isn't so obvious, if you're not a musician, is that when you are reading a passage in a book, you're coming across it for the very first time. And musicians will often study music before they actually play it or perform it. And the only time when they're not, we call that sight reading, when you're playing it, seeing it for the very, very first time, and it's really, really hard. And to go back to what I was saying before about reading, that we've forgotten that reading is this kind of inherently difficult task. You know, when we are reading prose, we're essentially performing the prose. That reading a book is not like listening to music. It's like performing music. And so that the prose of a book, the text of a book, is more like a score than it is something that gets performed for you. And I think that changes things. And, you know, and to come back to that idea of reading as a difficult thing, I said before it's like climbing a mountain. Well, it could also be likened to something like playing a video game, because if you're a 15-year-old kid, you don't seek out the easiest video game, right, to play. Right. You seek out the one that is going to challenge you, the one that is going to test you, that requires dexterity and concentration. And it strikes me as really interesting that so much of what people do with their leisure time is these kinds of activities that have this kind of inherent challenge to them. And I think we're forgetting that reading is one of those things.
And a lot of times, yeah, reading, it's like, I don't want to be challenged.
Right, yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, I even when you think about the word entertainment, I think there's a lot to consider there, because we would expect that books should entertain us, but in a different context, it takes on a totally different feel, because if you make me an offer or a proposal and I say I will entertain that offer, what I mean is I will think about it. I will consider that offer. And so what I suggest in this book is a different way of thinking of it, that books should not entertain us. We should entertain books, right? Mm. We should be considering and thinking about books and derive our pleasure from the fact that they kick us out of the torpor of regular everyday life, and they put us into a condition of thinking better than we normally do.
As a musician, I was really drawn to the idea that as you're reading, you're performing, you know, performing the book. And you know, as you said, it's sight reading, but it's also you can go back and try that again, that phrase again, or you can try that paragraph again, which is always a wonderful thing. And a lot of times you get new insights into what you're reading just by that careful reading.
Yeah, I think even in my early life, we think of writers and you know, particularly the really canonical writers, and they always talk about their early reading lives, and it seems so impossible that they were reading all these incredible books when they were very, very young. And that really wasn't my experience. I came to reading a little bit late. And on top of that, I discovered, you know, as maybe a lot of people do, that I wasn't a particularly good reader, that I had a tendency to drift as I read, that it was easy for me to lose my concentration. And so what I wound up doing was reading aloud to myself. So I would take a book to the beach and walk up and down the beach and read out loud to myself. And when you do that, that's when the reading as sight reading really became apparent to me, because you're trying to give voice to the author, and it changed how I process the words, and it kept me fixed on it too. And it was very effective. I recommend it.
This becomes a little problematic with books like Vox.
Sure. Yeah. So we're talking now about what often get referred to as Baker's sex novels. His most recent was the subtitle House of Holes, A Book of Raunch. And so, you know, you need to make sure you're in private.
Yeah, I think you were in Paris when you were reading Vox. I think, isn't that right?
I did fantasize about standing on a street corner and reading it out loud to the Parisians. But I could only do it in English, so maybe it wouldn't have made much sense.
But as you're getting into this world of Nicholson Baker, there is one thing that does bother you. And then, of course, there's this very funny moment later in the book where you say, you know, he uses these footnotes. These footnotes are driving me crazy. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm a person that kind of likes the footnotes, because usually there's a whole different narrative going on in a writer that's using footnotes. And it's like all of a sudden you're switching gears completely. You know, you sort of get the artifice of this is a story I've created and here I am down here in the footnotes. But you said this was bothering you.
Well, at first. Mm-hmm. At first it did. And, you know, because to my mind, when I was first reading the mezzanine, which is where these footnotes occur, you know, to my mind, the footnote was the thing that distinguished scholarly or academic writing from literary writing. And I always thought of footnotes as being the thing that that revealed the inelegance of that kind of writing. You don't know how to thread it in or transition to a different kind of thought, and so you just jam it in a footnote. It's like a way of shoehorning in an idea rather than really incorporating the idea. And what Baker's actually doing in that book is thinking back to the way that footnotes were used in the 19th century or much, much earlier traditions, and pointing out that sometimes, you know, footnotes could last a page. They were little miniature essays in and of themselves. And so what reading the mezzanine taught me and being frustrated by the footnotes was the recognition that it was slowing me down, that it was forcing me to pay attention, and that what I needed to do was really truly attend carefully to the book and essentially kind of move back and forth in my own consciousness between myself and the book in the same way that the text of the book and the footnotes moved back and forth. And once I made that connection, I understood it. So the book taught me how to read it.
Lo and behold, towards the end of the book, there's a footnote.
Sure, yes. I made sure to include one essay-length footnote.
But what you do a lot of times is that, that sort of going back and forth is sort of it's sort of the current of the book, really, between your own life and what you're reading.
Right, yeah.
And this reading life and then the rest of your life.
Yeah, and so the BME is really, you know, a story of competing love stories. You know, it's the story of my partner Catherine and I and our various travels and moves during the time that I'm reading Baker, and then it's also the story of reading Baker. So I love Baker's work, I love Catherine, two love stories.
Yeah.
And Marcel Proust once said something that's really interesting in his essay on reading. He said that the thing that we remember most about a book is where we were when we read it. And what that emphasizes to me is that the context of ourselves, who we are, where we are, what our life predicament is as we read, obviously has an impact on what we conclude a book might be about, or simply informs our experience of a book. But again, you know, in traditional writing about literature, literary criticism, you're not allowed to include that, right? You're not even really allowed to refer to yourself. And that seems really, really strange to me, if Proust is right. And so I wanted to tell a story that was both the story of my reading an author, but also the story of my life while I was doing that. And then to use that to demonstrate the way that our lives and our reading experiences are deeply intertwined.
The name of the book is Bee and Me. J.C. Hallman, thanks very much for joining.
Thanks, Rich.
J.C. Hallman is the author of Bee and Me, A True Story of Literary Arousal. It's published by Simon & Schuster. He teaches creative writing at Oklahoma State University, and he'll be the subject of a BookSmart Tulsa event this evening at 7 o'clock at Lucky's on the Green at the Guthrie Green. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.